Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday, February 23rd reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Biden, EU reveals sanctions. By Vladimir Ishinikov, Yuris Karamanu, Amar Madhani, and Eric Tucker of the Associated Press. Equal pay, U.S. soccer women's players to settle suit by Andrew Doss, the New York Times Company. And Bill prohibits officers from lying to children by Alex Burness, the Denver Post. Ukraine. Biden, EU reveal sanctions. Russian lawmakers vote to allow Putin to use military force outside the country. By Vladimir Ishinikov, Yuris Karamanu, Amar Madhani, and Eric Tucker, the Associated Press. Moscow. The East-West face-off over Ukraine escalated dramatically Tuesday when Russian lawmakers authorizing President Vladimir Putin to use military force outside his country and U.S. President Joe Biden and European leaders responding by slapping sanctions on Russian oligarchs and banks. Both leaders signaled that an even bigger confrontation could lie ahead. Putin has yet to unleash the force of the 150,000 troops massed on three sides of Ukraine, while Biden held back on even tougher sanctions that could cause economic turmoil for Russia, but said they would go ahead if there is further aggression. The measures, accompanied by repositioning of additional U.S. troops to the Baltic nation on NATO's eastern flank bordering Russia, came as Russian forces rolled into rebel-held areas in eastern Ukraine after Putin said he was recognizing the independence of the separatist regions in defiance of U.S. and European demands. Speaking at the White House, Biden said the Kremlin had flagrantly violated international law on what he called the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. He warned of more sanctions if Putin went further. "We are united in our support of Ukraine," Biden said. "We are united in our opposition to Russian aggression." When it comes to Russian claims of a justification or pretext for an invasion, Biden said, "None of us should be fooled. None of us will be fooled. There is no justification." Hopes for a diplomatic resolution to the threat of invasion, which U.S. officials have for weeks portrayed as all but inevitable, appeared to evaporate. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken canceled plans for a Thursday meeting in Geneva with his Russian counterpart, saying it would not be productive. Western nations sought to present a united front with more than two dozen European Union members unanimously agreeing to levy their own initial set of sanctions against Russian officials. Germany also said it was halting the process of certifying the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia, a lucrative deal long sought by Moscow. The U.S., meanwhile, moved to cut off Russia's government from Western France, sanctioning two of its banks and blocking it from trading its debt on American and European markets. The administration's actions hit civilian leaders in Russia's leadership hierarchy, and two Russian banks considered especially close to the Kremlin and Russia's military with more than $80 billion in assets. That includes freezing all of those banks' assets under U.S. jurisdictions. Biden, though, did not hold back some of the broadest and toughest of the financial penalties contemplated by the U.S., including sanctions that would reinforce the hold that Germany put on any startup of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, an export ban that would deny Russia U.S. high tech for its industries and military, and sweeping bans that would cripple Russia's ability to do business with the rest of the world. Biden said he was moving additional U.S. troops to the Baltics, though he described the deployment as purely defensive, asserting, "We have no intention of fighting Russia." The U.S. is sending about 800 infantry troops and 40 attack aircraft to the Baltics and NATO's eastern flank from other locations within Europe, according to a senior defense official. In addition, a contingent of F-35 strike fighters and AH-64 Apache attack helicopters will also be relocated. Earlier Tuesday, members of Russia's upper house, the Federation Council, voted unanimously to allow Putin to use military force outside the country, effectively formalizing a Russian military deployment to the rebel regions, where an 8-year conflict has killed nearly 14,000 people. Shortly afterward, Putin laid out 3 conditions to end the crisis that has threatened to plunge Europe back into war, raising the specter of massive casualties, energy shortages across the continent, and global economic chaos. Putin said the crisis could be resolved if Kiev recognizes Russia's sovereignty over Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that Moscow annexed after seizing it from Ukraine in 2014, renouncing its bid to join NATO, and partially demilitarizes. The West has decried the annexation of Crimea as a violation of international law and has previously flatly rejected permanently barring Ukraine from NATO. Asked whether he has sent any Russian troops into Ukraine and how far they would go, Putin responded, "I haven't said that the troops will go there right now." He added that it's impossible to forecast a specific pattern of action. It will depend on a concrete solution as it takes shape on the ground. The EU announced initial sanctions aimed at the 351 Russian lawmakers who voted for recognizing the 2 separatist regions in Ukraine, as well as 27 other Russian officials and institutions from the defense and banking sectors. They also sought to limit Moscow's access to EU capital and financial markets. Equal pay. U.S. soccer women's players to settle suit by Andrew Doss, the New York Times Company. For 6 years, the members of the World Cup winning U.S. women's soccer team and their bosses argued about equitable treatment of female players. They argued about whether artificial turf was a proper playing surface, about whether they deserve the same charter flights as their male counterparts, even about the definition of what constituted equal pay. But the long fight that set key members of the women's team against their bosses at U.S. Soccer ended on Tuesday just as abruptly as it had begun, with a settlement that included a multi-million-dollar payment to the players and a promise by their federation to equalize pay between the men's and women's national teams. Under the terms of the agreement, the athletes, a group of several dozen current and former players that includes some of the world's most popular and decorated female athletes, will share $24 million in payments from U.S. Soccer. The bulk of that figure is back pay, a tacit admission that compensation for the men's and women's team had been unequal for years. Perhaps more notable than the payment, though for the players certainly, but also for the federation, is U.S. Soccer's pledge to equalize pay between the men's and women's national teams in all competitions, including the World Cup, in the team's next collective bargaining agreements. That gap, once seen as an unbridgeable divide preventing any sort of equal pay settlement, if it is closed by the federation in negotiations with both teams, the change could funnel millions of dollars to a new generation of women's national players. It wasn't an easy process to get this point for sure, Cindy Parlow Cohn, U.S. Soccer's president, said in a telephone interview. "The most important thing here is that we are moving forward, and we are moving forward together." The players' long battle with U.S. Soccer, which is not only their employer but also the sport's national governing body, had thrust them into the forefront of a broader fight for equality in women's sports and drawn the support of fellow athletes, celebrities, politicians, and presidential candidates. In recent years, players, teams, and even athletes in other sports, ice hockey, Olympic gold medalists, Canadian soccer pros, and WNBA players, had reached out to the American soccer players and their union for help as they sought better pay and working conditions. Many of those players and teams won major gains. Norway, Australia, and the Netherlands are among the countries whose soccer federations have committed to closing the pay gap between men and women, even as the American players' case dragged on. I think it was just extremely motivating to see organizations and employers admit their wrongdoing and us forcing their hand and making it right, said Alex Morgan, a striker and former co-captain of the women's national team. The domino effect that helped kickstart, I think we're really proud of it. For U.S. soccer, the settlement is an expensive end to a conflict that had battered its reputation, damaged its ties with sponsors, and soured its relationship with some of its most popular stars, including Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Carly Lloyd, who retired last year. U.S. soccer was under no obligation to settle with the women's team. A federal judge in 2020 had dismissed the players' equal pay arguments, stripping them of nearly all their legal leverage, and the players' appeal was not certain to succeed. Yet for that reason, the settlement represents an unexpected victory for the players, nearly 2 years after losing in court in one devastating ruling. They were able to extract not only an eight-figure settlement, but also a commitment from the Federation to enact the very reforms the judge had rejected. What we set out to do, Morgan said in a telephone interview, was to have acknowledgement of discrimination from U.S. soccer, and we received that through back pay in the settlement. We set out to have fair and equal treatment and working conditions, and we got that through the working conditions settlement. And we set out to have equal pay moving forward for us and the men's team through U.S. soccer, and we achieved that. When finalized, the settlement will resolve all remaining claims in the gender discrimination lawsuit the players filed in 2019. But it came with one crucial condition. It is contingent on the ratification of a new contract between U.S. soccer and the players' union for the women's team. And that process could take weeks or even months. The men's and women's teams have already held joint negotiating sessions with U.S. Soccer, but to make the deal work, the Federation is seeking a single collective bargaining agreement that covers both teams. The men's players will have to agree to share or surrender millions of dollars in potential World Cup payments from FIFA, World Soccer's governing body. Those payments set by FIFA and exponentially larger for the men's World Cup than the corresponding women's tournament are at the heart of the equal pay divide. Cohn, a former member of the women's team, said in September that the Federation would not sign new collective bargaining agreements with either team that did not equalize World Cup prize money, a position she and the Federation cemented in Tuesday's agreement. The men's union, whose lawyers have been sitting in on some of the women's negotiating sessions, made no public statements on Tuesday. The equal pay fight began almost 6 years ago when five star players filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission accusing U.S. soccer of wage discrimination. The players, Morgan, Rapinoe, Lloyd, Becky Sauerbrunn, and Hope Solo, said they were being shortchanged on bonuses, appearance fees, and even meal money while they were in training camps, and contended they earned as little as 40% of what players on the men's national team were paid. The numbers speak for themselves, Solo said, though U.S. soccer immediately disputed them. Men's players, Solo said, get paid more just to show up than we get paid to win major championships. The Federation briefly argued that the men brought in more money and drew higher television ratings, and thus deserved higher pay, but soon abandoned the stance amid public backlash, player fury, and a closer reading of the equal pay law. State legislature, Bill prohibits officers from lying to children. But police defend the need for such deceptive tactics by Alex Bernas, the Denver Post. Shortly after Christmas 1994, 11-year-old Amber Doggett and her little sister were brought to the police station in Wenatchee, Washington, to answer some questions. The girls were separated, and later in an interrogation room, a detective asked Doggett if her parents had ever sexually abused her. They hadn't, she said. Yes, they had, the detective insisted. He said he knew that because Doggett's three older siblings had already said so and had described the abuse in detail to the police. He said it stood to reason that Doggett couldn't see this clearly as she'd been brainwashed. None of this was true. The siblings hadn't accused their parents or given detailed accounts. Doggett, who now lives in Grand Junction, hadn't been abused at all. It was legal at the time for police in every U.S. state to manipulate facts during interrogations. Lying to kids in this way remains legal in all but two states, with Colorado primed to become the third. Law enforcement officials in Colorado argue that lying can help secure information and confessions that build cases. The cops in Wenatchee, convinced at the time of a sexual abuse ring in their community that did not actually exist, were willing to manipulate the facts in order to build theirs. Doggett eventually relented. She lied to the cops, who lied to her, agreeing that she'd been abused. What the expletive was I supposed to do? I was 11 years old, Doggett said. It was nighttime. I couldn't just walk out of the police station alone. I was in a situation where everything was just so terrifying, my brain switched to survival mode. The next day, she was put through a sexual assault examination that humiliated her. The police told her the exam returned proof she had been abused by her parents. Another lie. The consequences of sham stretched for many years. Doggett was placed in foster care, and her parents were arrested, convicted, and sent to prison. She grew depressed and fell behind in school. She lost her appetite and started to self-harm and was eventually institutionalized and heavily medicated. She had a hard time trusting adults. Her parents were ultimately cleared of all charges, and the fictitious Wenatchee sex abuse ring was long ago debunked. She's doing much better now in Mesa County, where she's a social worker, but healing took time. I have just recently started to get my life together, but that didn't happen until I was in my early 30s, she said. I couldn't form trusting relationships. I couldn't form intimate relationships. The bill. Doggett detailed her experience before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which on February 10th passed the bill to ban police from lying to children in interrogations. SB 2223 on a party line vote. The bill would bar police officers plus anyone working with them on an interrogation of anyone under 18 in custody from using deception and false facts or beliefs in order to obtain a statement or an admission of guilt from that kid. The barred tactics would include lying about non-existent evidence or making false promises about how a kid can secure their freedom or at least a better outcome by telling police what they want to hear. SB 2223 would also create a baseline presumption that any statement or confession obtained through a deceptive tactics is not admissible in court. It would require police to electronically record all interrogations of children in custody. The lead sponsors, all Democratic women of color from Denver, say it's inappropriate and unnecessary for police to lie to secure information or confessions. If a case is sound, they argue, why toy with a subject by telling them, say, that police found fingerprints that they didn't actually find or have a video footage they didn't actually have? They argue that because kids are particularly susceptible to manipulation, it is urgent and even overdue for the legislature to create new protections. I don't think anybody should be lied to, but kids especially are still learning, still developing, said State Rep. Serena Gonzalez-Gutierrez, a sponsor who, outside of the legislature, has worked extensively with children in vulnerable situations. We keep hearing about the lack of trust with law enforcement. This is one way to try to rebuild that trust that kids could have with law enforcement. She remembers well the distrust she felt and observed among kids in Denver who looked like her. As a child in the backseat of her parents' car, she'd see Latino and Chicano children lined up on the curb, trapped for violating curfew laws that she knew were never enforced in white neighborhoods. For people in general and kids in heavily policed areas most of all, she said, genuine trust is impossible as long as one side has legal permission to tell lies. Her co-sponsor, Rep. Jennifer Bacon, is a former Denver school board member who has done dozens of Know Your Rights training sessions in local schools. I know how to be in white spaces with kids who don't ask the same questions, she said. The way they talk about law enforcement is to be helpful. How can I call police to help if I've been attacked? Those sorts of things. It's in non-white spaces, she said, where students are on a higher alert about being coerced and about the various ways that a single encounter with police can change a person or family forever. The data. There is not much documented evidence that police lies have created lots of situations comparable to Amber Doggett's in Colorado. The National Registration of Exonerations, housed at the University of Michigan, charged about 3,000 exonerations in the U.S. since 1989. Of that group, only 11 happened in Colorado. In only 3 of the 11 cases where the subjects younger than 18 at that date of the reported crime, of the 3,000, just more than 10% involved false confessions. But the women of color helming and backing this effort believe that for every shocking, headline-grabbing story like Doggett's, there are countless and mostly less dramatic instances of police deception against children. They believe this, they say, because they hear about it all the time. Democratic Senator Janet Buckner gets it from parents in her Aurora district. As a black woman with black children, I know that so many times what happens with the white kids doesn't happen with the black kids. And that's just a fact, she said. I know too many people who have been affected. She noted on the Senate floor recently that black youth are vastly overrepresented in Colorado youth detention centers and, according to the state's data, are also much more likely than white children to be referred to law enforcement at school. Said Bacon of the dearth of documented Colorado cases relevant to her bill, if 3 kids are lied to and they lose their lives in jail, that's bad enough. It shouldn't matter if it's 1,000 versus 3. But, she continued, it does matter when you talk to children, and I've done this like 40 times, and they all have the same questions, and it's all about same-looking kids that matters. If we keep seeing these disparities, they come from somewhere. The pushback. Law enforcement leaders in Colorado oppose this bill. So do Republicans. Democrats control both chambers of the Capitol plus the governor's office, and so they can and likely will pass this policy in spite of these protests. Last week, the Senate voted 18 to 16 to send the bill to the House. All 18 were Democrats. All 16, except for Democrat Joanne Ginnall of Fort Collins, were Republicans. The case against the bill rests largely on the ideas that it's not needed, as parents already have the right to accompany kids in interrogation rooms, and both parents and kids in those situations must be read Miranda rights. Opponents note that judges already have discretion to toss statements or confessions obtained through trickery if they're so inclined. They point to the lack of available data to bolster the Democrats' case, and they argue that deception is sometimes an important and useful tool that should not be outright banned. Let's say a detective is interviewing somebody in custody who's believed to have committed a murder outside the Capitol, said Democratic Boulder DA Michael Dougherty to the Senate Judiciary Committee, speaking on behalf of his fellow district attorneys in the state. The detective falsely says, I have video of you doing it, And then the person says, okay, you got me. I did it. This bill really highlights, is that appropriate or not? Should that be allowed or not? Should law enforcement be allowed to take the step? And there are a lot of reasons why the answer is yes. Dutch Smith, a veteran member of the Lakewood Police Department who spent a decade assigned to Lakewood High School, offered another scenario. A person has been murdered. A child is suspected of the murder but does not know at the time of the interrogation that the victim is indeed dead. I want to continue my investigation, Smith testified in the Senate. If you tell them right away the person is deceased, they may not want to talk to anyone. The movement. Research suggests that if accuracy is the goal, lying doesn't always help. That, many expect criminologists say, is because the more convincing an authority sounds, the more inclined a child is to go along with the story. Kids are statistically overrepresented in the archives of false confessions, said Saul Kassin, a professor who studies false confessions at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, to the Senate committee. Kids are more compliant in the face of authority, more likely to surrender, to capitulate, more suggestible. Backers of the bill argue that a false confession not only hurts the person giving the confession, but harms public safety too. An innocent person behind bars means a guilty person who got away with it, bill sponsor Julie Gonzalez, a Democrat from Denver, told her colleagues during the chamber's debate. Said Kassin, when people are under great stress, they want nothing more than to get out of this bad situation, no matter what it takes. They're not thinking about future consequences. They just, I got to do what it takes to make this stop, and children have more of that tendency than adults do. Doggett knows the feeling. I had no power, she said. I repeatedly expressed what I wanted, which was to go home, and I was repeatedly denied that. They weren't believing me, and they wouldn't let me go home. So I felt I had no choice but to lie. I didn't see any other way of getting out of that room. What makes the tactic of deception so devastating, Kassin said, is that most people, and especially kids, don't know what police are allowed by law to lie in this way. Several lawmakers even told the Denver Post they weren't aware the tactic was sanctioned in this and other states. It's been banned in countries like England, France, Spain, Norway, Belgium, Sweden, Australia, and Japan. The Colorado bill fits into a national movement that already includes laws shielding kids from interrogation lies in Illinois and Oregon, and can soon include new laws in several other states. The sky has not fallen in places that took this step, Kassin told lawmakers. What has happened is that they've had a curtailment of false confession cases. Still, many Colorado lawmakers, though likely not a majority, find this unpersuasive and believe that while the legislature can and should improve protections for kids, those moves must not interfere with the ability of law enforcement to solve crimes. Banning deception tactics, argued former Weld County Sheriff and current state Senator John Cook, is an anti-law enforcement and anti-public safety pro-criminal. He appealed to his fellow senators before the chamber's final vote last week. What if it was your kid? What if it was your child that was kidnapped and the only way to get him back was to say a deceptive statement to the juvenile that might have information? What if it was your child that was murdered? Wouldn't you want law enforcement to use every tool that they have in their tool belt to solve the crime? Senator Kerry Donovan, a Democrat of Vail, took the lectern after him. A good question to ponder, she said. I would ask us to ponder the flip side of that coin. Wouldn't you want your kid who was in a scary situation to not be led into a conversation that could weigh them down for the balance of their lives? Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Cletus Bud Byrne, Jr., 1930 to 2022. A St. Louis boy born and bred, Bud graduated from McBride High School. After serving in the U.S. Army, During the Korean conflict, Bud returned to St. Louis, where he graduated from St. Louis University with a degree in accounting and began a 51-year career in the investment business. In 1962, he was transferred to Denver and fell in love with Colorado. He had a distinguished career, including service on the Board of Governors of the National Association of Security Dealers and as an NASD arbitrator for 30 years. He also served on the Lay Advisory Board at St. Mary's Academy for 16 years. After retiring, Bud pursued his passions for travel and spending time with family and friends. He was preceded in death by his first wife, Nancy Nangle Byrne, second wife, Leah Schozel, and third wife, Kay Chorley Grossman Byrne. His parents, Cletus Sr. and Mary Bess Byrne, brother David Donald Byrne, wife Loretta, sister Audrey Merkel, husband George, and brother-in-law Charles Schwinderman. He is survived by sister Elizabeth Betty Schwinderman, daughters Elizabeth Byrne, husband Robert, and Barb Waffle, husband Steve, grandson Drew Waffle, wife Julia, granddaughter Ann Clinton, great-grandson Declan Waffle, and many stepchildren and step-grandchildren, sisters and brothers-in-law, nieces and nephews. Bud was a quintessential people person, known for his joy de vivre and lively sense of humor. He was always ready with a story or a one-liner. Despite the untimely death of his first wife, Nancy, he went on to find love with Leah, and after her passing, once again with Kay. Though he faced numerous health challenges in his last years, he never lost his optimism or his thoughtfulness and generous spirit. He will be deeply missed by all who had the pleasure of knowing him. A special thanks to Lisa Lowe for her steadfast love and friendship and to his wonderful caregivers. Donation in Bud's memory may be made to St. Mary's Academy, 4545 St. South University Boulevard, Inglewood, Colorado, 80112. www.stmarys.academy/donate. Arupe Jesuit High School, 4343 Utica Street, Denver, 80212. www.arupejesuit.com/give. A celebration of life will take place in Denver, Friday, February 25th, funeral mass and interment in St. Louis, Missouri, Saturday, February 26th, 2022, 10 a.m., the Old Cathedral. Lois Johanna Cavanis, July 20th, 1931 to January 1st, 2022. Lois Johanna Hartmeyer Cavanis, January 20th, 1931 to January 1st, 2022, passed away on January 1st, 2022 at the age of 90 with her children by her side. Lois's greatest legacy she modeled for her children were integrity, hard work, and the love of learning, books, and travel. Born in Spokane, Washington on July 20th, 1931, Lois was an early reader and also taught herself to play piano by ear. Lois grew up in Eastern Washington town of Fairfield, Washington. As a youth, she traveled to the Eastern Washington area playing duets at a wide variety of functions. From a very early age, Miss Hartmeyer rode her horses in the annual Fairfield Flag Day Parade and then eventually helped train and show horses in and around Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. A valedictorian of her Fairfield High School class of 1949, and a daughter of the American Revolution winner, Lois went to the honors program at Washington State College, graduating summa cum laude in 1953 to become a high school English teacher. Her first teaching job was in the logging town of Newport, Washington. It was there she met World War II Navy veteran Robert Cavanis, who was teaching and coaching at Newport High School. Bob proposed on their third date. They were married on August 1st of 1954. They were married for 54 years at the time of Bob's passing in 2019. The couple moved to Colorado in 1956 in order for Lois Jo to begin her master's degree in library sciences at DU Women's College. Their stay in Colorado was to be temporary, but they found happiness, friends, success, and development, a love of the varied landscape of Colorado. Lois has also developed a love of Southwest Native American art and gardening in Colorado. Lois Jo initially started teaching in the Denver Public Schools at Smiley Junior High and eventually moved to Aurora Public Schools. She taught English at North Junior High School for several years before their children were born. She returned to work as a librarian at Gateway High School for 17 years and presented on library topics at several regional and national conferences. Lois was also a very active member of the Alpha Delta Kappa, aka for Women Educators, for many years. Lois Cavanis retired from 32 years of teaching and being a librarian in 1991. Lois's love affair with Chihuahuas began in the 1950s after Bob bought her a puppy as a present. Robert and Lois were members of several AKC breeders associations in Colorado. Lois showed many Chihuahuas for over the years. Cavaness's Chihuahuas were known throughout the USA and the American Kennel Club for their excellent conformation and outgoing temperament. Lois had two number one puppies in the nation and had several nationally ranked Chihuahuas. In all, Lois finished 48 champion Chihuahuas, the majority of them owner bred and handled. After retiring from showing dogs, Lois and Bob became avid birders who traveled to several states to enjoy the natural beauty and birds. Lois also enjoyed traveling to Europe and South America with family and friends. Lois was preceded in death by her parents, Henry Joseph Hartmeyer and Crystal Frances Severna Sorensen Hartmeyer, her sister Barbara Hartmeyer Browning, and her beloved husband Robert Franklin Cavaness. She is survived by her children, Craig Cavaness, wife Vicky, and Marla Cavaness French, husband Rob, and six beloved grandchildren, Ryan, Caitlin, Aaron, RJ, Zach, and Hannah, who inherited Lois's love of learning, books, and travel. A celebration of life will take place Sunday, March 6, 2022 at 12 p.m. at Stonebrook Manor in Thornton, Colorado. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that you make a donation to your favorite high school library to help keep the love of books and learning going strong in high schools, and or an animal shelter to help care for animals in need, and or the Fairfield Flag Day at Fairfield Service Club, P.O. Box 198, Fairfield, Washington, 99012, attention Fairfield Flag Day. Thank you to the caregivers of the Visiting Angels Aurora, Bayeda Home Healthcare, Seasons Hospice, and Bonaventure Senior Living in Thornton for their care of Lois. Huge thank you to Janet Howell for her excellent care and friendship with Lois and kind guidance over the last several years. Thoughts and memorials can be sent to 2022loisc@gmail.com. If you are planning on attending Lois' celebration of life on March 6, 2022 at 12 p.m., an RSVP would be greatly appreciated due to the ongoing concerns around coronavirus. Her family would like to make sure the room is set up with appropriate social distancing. Please email RSVPs to 2022loisc@gmail.com or RSVP Lois Cavaness Celebration of Life Google Form. Richard Ward Gast. January 23, 1926 to February 10, 2022. 96, passed away on Thursday, February 10, 2022. Service will be held Saturday, February 26, 2022 at 10 a.m. at Olinger Crown Hill. Visit crownhillfuneral.com for full obituary. Tony Haley, September 29th, 1937 to February 13, 2022. Adios, Tony. Tony Haley left the building on Sunday morning, February 13, 2022. His favorite music, Pink Floyd plays to his beloved Nancy, his four sons, Mike, Jack, Curtis, and Kyle, grandkids, and close family wrapped him in with their love. He loved being a dad and was good at it. Although not for reasons he would have chosen, the gathering of friends and family was of great comfort. As he had lived his whole life, he wasn't afraid, but rather accepting of the next unknown steps and concern for the people he would leave behind. He was also always bold and willing to take risks. Other than Nancy and his family, one of his great loves for the last 22 years was Mexico. Everything about it was good for him. He was a fierce yet low-key competitor in business, as in all things, finding a way to generally get what he wanted mostly with street smarts and charm, and largely without conflict. His partners will remember him as tough, fair, and diligent. Tony made friends easily and proved to be loyal in the long run. Some of his best early pals were Fijis at Bucknell, with whom he caroused and celebrated for more than 60 years. His golfing buddies on both sides of the border were always willing co-conspirators, knowing he was the glue that kept the whole crew together. Nancy described her Tony as authentic, hugely generous, rarely uncertain, independent of convention, never self-important, and always comfortable with who he was. He had so many loyal friends from a wide spectrum of backgrounds and personality. They all loved him dearly, and none among them ever knew a man so full of good nature and absolute unrivaled good humor. As Nancy has said, Tony lived his life to the fullest and reminded us all how it can be done with grace and humor. His friends and family will agree and confirm that he was one of a kind. No doubt his memory will spark a smile or chuckle, which would be exactly what he would want. There will be a non-traditional Tony-style celebration of life, his loves and his foibles when Colorado warms up and the courses are green. There will be many rounds of tequila and good cigars. Tony would expect nothing less. Stay tuned, amigos. Edie Udine Hockett, August 15, 1944 to February 19, 2022. Edie Udine Hockett passed away on February 19, 2022 in Louisville, Colorado, with her family by her side. She was 77. Edie was born August 15, 1944 in Andover, Kansas. She was raised by her mother, Irma Nelson Mullins, and father, Robert E. Mullins, in Andover and Wichita, Kansas, before moving to Boulder, Colorado in 1958. There she met the love of her life, Howard Wendell Hockett. They married February 16, 1963, and they enjoyed over 35 years together until his passing in 2000. Edie remained in Boulder until 2020, when she moved to Broomfield, Colorado. She worked at the Boulder County Clerk and Recorder's Office, Boulder Valley Public Schools, and then for many years in State Farm insurance offices, where she made close friends and enjoyed helping countless clients with their policies and claims. Edie enjoyed spending time with her family and watching westerns, playing slot machines, playing board and card games, traveling, bowling, and dancing. She is preceded in death by her parents, her husband, two brothers, Alan L. Wilson of Longmont, Colorado, and Alfred L. Wilson of Wichita, Kansas, her father-in-law, Wendell C. Hockett, mother-in-law, Verda B. Edie, is survived by her two children, Robert L., wife Laura Hockett of Wellesley, Massachusetts, Stacy L., husband Adam Morgan of Westminster, Colorado, four grandchildren, Julia L. Hockett of Zurich, Diana L. Hockett of Boston, Massachusetts, Sarah A. Hockett of London, United Kingdom, and Benjamin T. Morgan of Westminster, Colorado, brother Robert E., wife Eleanor Mullins, Jr. of Lakewood, Colorado, sisters-in-law Sigrid Wilson of Longmont, Colorado, Judy D. Larson of Westminster, Colorado, and Mona Wilson of Wichita, Kansas. brother-in-law Robert P. Larson of Westminster, Colorado, nieces Cameron Gibson, Famor Rasmussen Jr. of Longmont, Colorado, Karen Giesler of Loveland, Colorado, Brandy C., wife, husband Eric Waters of Tacoma, Washington, Elaine C., husband Michael Fay of San Diego, California, Melissa L., husband Greg Nunn of Temecula, California, and Stephanie C. Hooker of Colorado, nephews Gary L., wife Angela Wilson of Erie, Colorado, Robert E. Mullins III of Venice Beach, California, Corey Moore of Arkansas, David W. Hockett of Georgia, Aunt Violet L. West of Wichita, Kansas, and other extended family in Colorado, Kansas, and elsewhere. A memorial service will be held at 12 p.m. on Friday, February 25th, 2022 at Greenwood and Myers Mortuary, 2969 Baseline Road, Boulder, Colorado, 80303, with an on-site reception to follow. Memorial donations may be made to the Humane Society of Boulder Valley, 2323 55th Street, Boulder, Colorado, 80301, or boulderhumane.org. To attend the funeral virtually through Zoom, the meeting ID number is 813-4470-7484, or join from link us06web.zoom.us/j/813-447-0784 or telephone number 720-707-2699. Francis Martinez, 1928 to 2022, 93 of Denver, passed away January 16, 2022. She is survived by her husband, Cecil, her children, Patsy, husband, Gary, Cecil, Harry, Yvonne, many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and friends. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, February 26, 2022 at 11 a.m. at Lakewood United Methodist Church, 1390 Brentwood, Lakewood, Colorado, 80214. Ellen Spellman, May 14th, 1932 to January 27th, 2022. A visitation will be held on February 25th, 2022 from 9 a.m. to 9 a.m., followed by a funeral mass at 10 a.m. on Shrine of St. Anne Catholic Church, 7555 Grant Place, Arvada, Colorado, 80002. For full obituary, see HoranCares.com. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. How to Lower Your Grocery Costs When Prices Are Soaring, by Nicole Norfleet, Minneapolis Star Tribune. Grocery runs have gotten more expensive. Anyone who has taken a look at their receipts in the last few months can tell that prices have gone up on nearly everything from chicken wings to milk as inflation levels reached highs we haven't seen in decades. The cost of food that people eat at home rose 6.5% in December compared to the same month the year before. That's well above what people were used to. Over the last 20 years, the cost of supermarket purchases rose about 2% a year on average. If you are not careful, you're going to have a full cart and be shocked at how much you spent, said Haley Nelson of St. Paul, Minnesota, who has shared low-cost recipes on her blog, Cheap Recipe Blog, for more than a decade. Inflation may slow this spring and summer from last year, but price increases may still be higher than normal. Here are some ways you can plan and shop to better stretch your grocery budget. Plan your trip and don't get distracted. When is the last time you really looked in your pantry? The first step is to take stock of what's in your fridge and cupboards. That will prevent you from buying items you already have. Do you plan your meals or do you pick up whatever strikes you in the store? Impulse is the grocer's best friend and temptations are everywhere, said Stephen Plant, a financial planner at Raymond James and Wayzata Minnesota who owned a local grocery store for 15 years. Go to the grocery store with a list. This is really not the time to wing it, Nelson said. Having a list helps you stay focused on what you need so you don't overspend on extra items. Don't shop while hungry and avoid picking up unplanned processed foods such as frozen dinners. Learn your store. Discover your grocery store's hidden finds such as discount sections. Many grocery stores have sections or bins with soon-to-expire food or bruised foods that are all still good to eat, said Jamie Fool, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. Two of the best places to get deals in the bulk section of spices at local food cooperatives and the salad bar at grocery stores, where you can get a small scoop of ingredients like bacon bits, Nelson said. Having a better grasp on prices of your everyday items and the pricing of an array of stores instead of relying on just one can also be helpful. Broadening your horizons probably can help your household budget, Fool said. Don't forget about coupons and reward programs offered by your grocery and manufacturers. Whether it's in print or digital, coupons can still save you money, Fool said. Print circulars like the ones in this paper can also alert you to good deals. Most stores also offer incentive programs where buyers can get discounts on food, gas, and other perks, so don't forget to swipe your card at checkout. Stay flexible for good deals. Sometimes you can find similar or cheaper products at another part of the grocery store. If one doesn't need a fancy cheese from a deli department, they can often save by buying similar cheese from the dairy department, said Plant of Raymond James. If there are products that your family uses on a regular basis, it wouldn't be a bad idea to grab it when you see it because it's still hard to keep certain popular items stocked, Fool said. But try not to hoard, she warned. Be flexible on what you buy and try different brands. Different sizes of products and even different product in the same category. Because of supply chain issues, if you like product X, you may need to buy product Y, Fool said. However, pay attention to the price per ounce. Smaller sizes are another form of inflation, Plant said. For example, ice cream used to come in half gallon, 64-ounce cartons, and now may come in 48 to 56-ounce sizes. Stretch your meals and find substitutions. To make meals stretch, repurpose cooked food and other meals throughout the week, Nelson said. She used pork she slow-cooked recently for several meals, including a rice bowl and pulled pork tacos. When planning meals, identify four or five typically low-cost ingredients that you can sub into your diet, such as bananas, chicken thighs, and beans, Nelson said. If you can save $10 twice a week over time, that all adds up, she said. One substitution people are talking about these days is going meatless. By far the largest increase in at-home food costs last year in the U.S. was for meat, poultry, fish, and eggs, up 12.6% in December compared to the year before. With the price of meat so high, you can save a considerable amount of money and likely see some health benefits if you go meatless 1 or 2 days a week or even a few meals per week, Nelson said. There are so many ways to make this work, even for people who are big meat eaters, she said. Oats, peanut butter, beans, lentils, rice, eggs, potatoes, and other vegetables are great staple ingredients for meat-free diets and are cheap alternatives to manufactured plant-based products. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday, February 23rd edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.